fisherman said, you're not right. Now I'm staying up all night.
Hey friends, it's the Crow Boys. Our debut album, Made to Wonder, is out now.
Download and stream it wherever you listen to music.
Hey everyone, this is Ismay, musician, host, and creator of Finding Lucinda. In anticipation of our documentary film coming out this fall, I've put together an in-depth companion podcast. It delves into the origins and artistry of legendary singer-songwriter Lucinda Williams. New episodes are out every other week on the BGS Podcast Network. So join me on this creative journey. As I set out to look into the origins and development of Lucinda Williams, I decided to look towards characters from her early life. People that could speak to her personality, the skills, the talent, her mindset when she was just getting started. And a good place to start looking for those characters was by doing research into her earliest albums. Up until Lucinda was 25 years old, in 1978, she had never been into a studio. She'd hung out, performed, written songs, but she'd never made a record. There was this folk singer she was hanging out with. He knew that at the time, Lucinda really had this goal of being a singer-songwriter as a career. And so he told her, hey, if you send a cassette to this guy, Moses Ash, he might put out your album. You're listening to Finding Lucinda from The Bluegrass Situation. I'm your host, Ismay. This podcast is an audio documentary. It recounts a journey that I took a couple of years ago. I was living on my family's ranch and pursuing music part-time, but I was looking for a change. I wanted to move forward with my creative aspirations fully, but I didn't know where to begin. So I made a decision to embark on a road trip. During that trip, I would look towards my musical hero, Lucinda Williams, for guidance about what to do. You're listening to Episode 5, Lucinda's First Guitarist. So Lucinda heard about this guy, Moses Ash, from a fellow folk singer. He managed a label called Folk Ways. It was associated with the Smithsonian. And this label released albums by famous artists that influenced Lucinda. Lead Belly, Pete Seeger. So she got a cassette tape together of a few covers that she was performing live at the time. I imagine her back then in 1978, hopeful to move forward. She slips a cassette tape into a package and seals it up at the post office, nervous about the reception of the cassette and wondering if it would even get to Moses in the mail. A few weeks after she sent her cassette in the mail to Moses, she got a letter back. Mo Ash offered to pay $300 for Lucinda's first record. She went out to meet him in person in New York City and made plans to make her record. Mo Ash died in the mid-1980s, so I couldn't ask him about his experience with putting out Lucinda's first record, about what she was like at the time and what he thought of her music. But I went to the liner notes of that first album, called Ramblin' on My Mind, and there I found a name that intrigued me. It was the only other person who played on this record. And the name was of a guitarist, John Grimaldo. I had not heard anything about John Grumato up to that point. A Google search didn't reveal much at all. No website, no social media. There were a few blogs that mentioned his name, but they were mostly in reference to the album Ramblin' on My Mind that he made with Lucinda. It seemed like this John Grumato guy had kept a pretty low profile since the making of that record. He was a mystery to me. In order to dig a little bit deeper, I headed to the newspaper archives online. As I searched, I found a handful of print articles that mentioned his name. Interestingly, these articles revealed that John was associated with two other notable artists. One newspaper article described how the famous country artist Lyle Lovett was influenced by John Grumato back in the 1970s. A second article was written about Nancy Griffith and how she had covered one of John Grumato's songs that was from that same era. So it turned out that Mr. Grumato had a significant influence on an array of country folk artists, but there was little evidence of what John had been up to between the 70s and the present. And I wondered, what happened in these past decades? Had anything changed between that time when John Grumato was brushing elbows with these prominent artists and now? And also, of course, I wondered if John could give me insight into what Lucinda Williams was like back when they collaborated on her first record together. Finding John Grumato was a challenge. As I mentioned, he didn't have an online presence. There were not references to email contacts or management, but a friend found a way. She contacted a guy who worked at Malico Studios where Ramblin' on My Mind was made. And after all these years, he had a contact for John. I found out something else fascinating about John and Lucinda's creative relationship. Not only had he played with Lucinda on her first record, but he had also played with her early on in Houston, Texas. It was at this legendary venue called Anderson Fair. So I decided to reach out to John and to Anderson Fair and set up an interview with him there. In order to study up before I took my trip to Houston, I watched a documentary. It was called For the Sake of a Song, The Story of Anderson Fair. And Lucinda was interviewed in it. But more incredibly, there was something even more special. In that documentary film that came out just a couple of years ago, I saw the earliest ever recording of Lucinda. There, in black and white footage, she stood up on stage with a straw hat, singing, "Ramon, Ramon, don't you think it's all right?" It appeared that it wasn't even a cover. It was a rare original. That documentary, in addition to showing this incredibly early Lucinda footage, also showed something else, even more incredible. Something that a songwriter like me fantasizes about. A scene, a community, a place that was built around the love of music. While the venue started out as a restaurant, it quickly became a hangout. Hippies, writers, musicians, artists, and weirdos all gathered around this place. It was a songwriting sanctuary. Talents like Townes Van Zandt, Lyle Lovett, Robert Earl Keen all played there in the early days. According to this documentary, Anderson Fair was a place where, quote, free thinkers gathered to talk about the things that might get them arrested somewhere else. This was a kind of a place where a musician could get a cheap meal to stay afloat. It was the kind of a place where a songwriter would host their wedding reception and the room would be filled with a community of artists just like them. It was always difficult to keep a place like that going financially, so each year, all the musicians would gather around and create a block party. They raised just enough money that one time each year to pay for the rent and a couple of repairs. Well, on my trip, I brought my truck over to Houston, to the bumpy streets, to the winding neighborhoods, and I pulled up to Anderson Fair. The building was exactly how it had looked in the documentary. The left side was a barn-shaped building, two stories high, with something you'd call a gambrel roof. It was as if a rooster was about to crow out of the top window. The wood and brick exterior was painted light brown and white, same color as it used to be. It was as if nothing had changed as far as that building was concerned. But the neighborhood around the venue had certainly changed significantly. Maybe not the way you'd think. You see, in Houston, they have this thing where they don't do zoning like other cities. So instead of controlling the neighborhoods to be one thing or the other, like a venue being surrounded by other venues or houses, it had some odd companions. There was a big old warehouse across the street. And while I was visiting, people kept shuffling these metal pipes on carts back and forth. And right next to Anderson Fair, hulking over, was a metal-sided square modern building. Maybe another warehouse. But nevertheless, the place was incredibly charming. John Grimato walked up the sidewalk towards me. He didn't look like the few images that I had found of him back in the day. His hair was now gray, not its rich brown, but he still had a mustache. And he stepped slowly and carefully along the pavement. He held an old beat-up guitar case. We met and started chatting on the bench outside of the venue. I was immediately comfortable with him. He was sweet, modest, easy to be around.
I saw your name up on the wall.
Oh, you did?
I did.
Yeah, it's probably an old poster. I haven't played there myself in over 20 years. So.
Wow.
Yeah, yeah. They had music 7 nights a week during the 70s, and there was a lot of talent, so there were plenty of gigs all through Montrose, but this was the mecca for songwriters and acoustic music. Yeah, and I got a lot of gigs here during that time.
So do you remember playing here with Lucinda a little bit?
I do. I do. I remember she had that 12-string, Martin 12-string, and there were no electronic tuners back then, so she had this tuning fork, and she would bing and put it on, bing, and then she'd try to tune to that. She'd get kind of frustrated sometimes, but she was good at tuning, and we had a lot of fun. She was just seemed like starting to write original music, but mostly we played traditional music, old blues and stuff back then, you know, and we made that record together, of course, so. You know, and I don't think any of those songs on the record were hers, actually, you know?
Yeah, I think you're right. They're all covers.
Mm-hmm.
So what were some of the, like, blues artists that you were and other artists you were inspired by for, like, your playing?
Well, of course, Lightnin' Hopkins, he lived here. You could go see him all the time. And then this man who called himself a songster, but he was from Navasota, Texas, named Mance Lipscomb. Mm. He was really good. I don't know if you're familiar with him that much, but... He was a big inspiration to me, one of my majors, you know.
And did you, I know that a lot of the songs on the record are like Robert Johnson and Memphis Minnie, and and sounds kind of inspired by Mississippi John Hurt too, a little bit, some of his work.
Yeah, yeah, he was one of my main influences, I guess, that kind of three-finger folk picking blues like he did. Yeah, Lucinda really liked Mississippi John Hurt too. She really liked him a lot. In fact, I think the first Mississippi John Hurt record I ever heard, she played it for me.
Really?
Yeah, I think she was house-sitting over here, and she invited me to come over, and that was one of the times we were going to rehearse a little bit. I think we were going to play here that night, and she said, look, I want to do this John Hurt song, so we listened to the record, and that was the first time I'd heard that. So, yeah, wow. I was real young. I was probably in my 20s for sure, you know.
Mm-hmm. What did you hear in Lucinda's, you know, style early on?
Well, she just seemed to have that traditional, more traditional flavor, and I liked her interpretation of the blues song. She would get that little vocal thing, like that going, you know, that thing she does. I can't do it. I'm sorry. I can't do it. But you know what I'm talking about. Yeah. And that was kind of, I thought it was kind of interesting the way she interpreted those songs. I really did. Mm-hmm. And she was just starting, when we played here, I can't remember too many original songs we did of hers. But I can remember toward the end, before some of our last gigs, she had written some songs and showed them to me. And I thought they were really good and that they could do something, you know. Mm. I remember that.
Yeah.
But as far as playing any of those songs with her too much, we might have done two or three at one of the last gigs we played together. But she wasn't writing songs back then. She was more or less into this old-timey blues and traditional music, you know. Carter Family, all that kind of stuff.
Yeah.
You know, so.
So she had a unique style, like a unique voice.
Mm-hmm. She did. Very unique. It was different. Different than anybody else that played here, that's for sure.
Yeah.
And she always told me after the record, she says, we're going to get out of here. She was going to go places.
Yeah.
I don't think we even played a year together. Maybe right at a year, but it couldn't have been over a year. And then she was gone, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So.
Yeah.
That's cool.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Do you want to go in and look at this place a little bit? Or?
We should. I mean, I think we might do a little bit of playing.
It had been 20 years since John Grimaldo had been at Anderson Fair. I could see his eyes looking about. Memories were flooding into his head. The interior of this place was just as intact as the exterior. There were still the old brick floors where Lucinda must have walked. And in the back of the room was a counter. Looked like there was a kitchen behind it. That must be where they used to serve spaghetti lunches. While it was quite similar visually to how it used to be, in a lot of ways Anderson Fair wasn't the same. It wasn't open day to day. It did have wonderful occasional concerts. But what it was back in the 70s, it just wasn't that anymore. Testaments to the history of this amazing venue were all over the walls. Photos of the famous songwriters who played there. Schedules from the 1970s showing Lucinda's name and John's name.
Thank you.
After you.
Thank you.
This is the old place.
Wow. None of these pictures were here last time I came, but which was over 20 years ago. They had 8x10 glossy pictures on this wall of everyone that almost that had ever played there. And they just had them stapled to the wall. They weren't framed and fancy like these star pictures are that are up there now. This is completely different. But this was the room where Anderson Fair originated. And it was a restaurant. It was called Anderson Fair Retail Restaurant in the beginning. Mm. And they were only open for lunch. And sometimes in the evenings, I think a couple of days they'd open. But they would let a musician or two come in and sit here and play, I think, in this corner. They had some tables out here, three or four round tables with a couple of chairs. And businessmen would come eat, hippies, all kinds of people would come eat here. It was really people from all walks of life. It was kind of interesting, you know.
And so did you play with Lucinda in that corner there?
I think we probably did a couple of lunches from what I can remember. I think we did. Wow. And then after the lunches, I think I told you once that musicians would come after the hours. Say lunch was 11 to 2. After 2 o'clock, some musicians would sometimes show up and come to get some leftover spaghetti to eat. You know, like maybe they needed a little extra funding that month. And so then musicians would also come sometimes to just hang out and swap songs and see what other musicians had written that week. And it was just kind of a melting pot where people were kind of bouncing off of each other, all these writers. Nancy Griffiths, Eric Taylor, Lucinda, Lyle came in later. By the time Lyle came, they had a bigger room right here. They bought that building and moved into this room that we'll go in later on. But but this was basically, you can see how small it is.
Yeah.
It was real small in the beginning.
Yeah.
And this room, can we walk in here for a sec? I haven't even seen this. Oh, wow. This is unreal. It didn't look anything like this, though, back then. The books still look the same, but time moves on, I guess.
Yeah, always changing, huh?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
In this larger performance area, there were little tables, like the kind that you see at an Italian restaurant, where each table has a small candle, enough room for one couple, and maybe a third person to gather around. And although it was the daytime when I was there with John, I could picture it. A crowd of appreciative people sitting quietly. I imagined myself up there in Lucinda's day. The rush of knowing that there was a group of people there who wanted to hear my songs. The microphones set up, a little stool, perhaps a set of shaking hands.
And we always played that song, Palette on Your Floor, every gig. She always liked, that was one of her favorites. That one and Jug Band Music were the two that I remember. We used to do that one almost every time. So, Well, you want to try one?
Yeah, let's do Palette.
Okay.
Although the Cactus Cafe and the Hole in the Wall in Austin were great, there was something special that I discovered at Anderson Fair. I found a story of a venue with a real community of artists, and that even included people who went on to become extraordinarily successful. I found a tale of the two things I was really looking for in my life. First, belonging to a group of people like me, and second, people who found their voice, ones who eventually got acceptance to a large audience of supportive fans. Anderson Fair was the kind of place I had always hoped I could find. Living on the ranch, I had glimpses of such things, but nothing close to what this venue sounded like in the 1970s. This is not at all what I expected to find when I set out to interview John Grimaldo. Uncovering what John and Lucinda had been part of was like finding a $20 bill on the sidewalk, an unexpected gift that filled my heart with glee. But Anderson Fair, as John and the documentary had described it, was long gone. It had been 40 years. I wanted to ask John about what happened between that time, back when those memories were formed there in Houston in the 70s, and today, between the days when he was part of a songwriting community with people like Nancy Griffith and Lucinda, and where he was at on the coast of Texas. I wondered, had he achieved his dreams? Was he fulfilled with what he had done?
So tell me about yourself and your kind of music career. Like, what were you kind of looking to do?
Oh, you know, I consider myself a guy that kind of studies music more. And I really didn't have any big time dreams to do anything. I mean, if they would have presented themselves, it would have been nice. But I just stayed down on the coast, and caught redfish, and played a lot of local gigs. And that was good enough for me. Come up here once every couple of months and play a gig, you know. But no, I stayed down on the South Texas coast and had a good time. It was fun to me. There was pretty good music going on down there too at that time. So I would have liked to have made it big and pushed some of my songs, but really didn't know how to go about it and didn't have an agent or anything, you know. So, but that's okay. I'm still here and I'm still playing, so, you know.
Yeah. I guess I'm curious if you ever had sort of that sort of need to make a decision between music and other priorities.
Sure. When I went to Rockport and we got married, my wife and I, we lived out at Katy, Texas with my grandfather till he passed, and then had to move out and went to Rockport. My wife had a son previously who I adopted at 1 year old, and I just had to make a decision. Okay, and now I've got a family. Am I going to try to go on the road and play? And when we left Katy, Texas, I asked my wife, I said, we didn't know where we were going to go. I said, do you want to go to Austin? I can probably play some music up there. Or do you want to go down to South Texas? I'd taken her to Rockport, and she wouldn't say, because I don't think she wanted to influence what we did. So I just took a quarter of my pocket, heads Austin, tails Rockport. It came up tails, and we moved there and been there ever since.
Wow.
So, but it's kind of it's a tough thing, you know. Do you want to go play gigs and be away from your family and eat motel food and all that? Is that, and make money and have people look at you and say, oh man, that guy's cool? Or is it just as cool to stay home and catch your own food and just be able to pay your bills and live life? You know, it's a tough decision what to do, kind of, you know. Finances play into it also, you know. If I could have made a lot of money playing music more, I probably would have considered going out on the road. But I didn't think at that time my chances were that great playing the stuff that I play, you know.
So you didn't feel like you didn't feel confident in your ability to make it work financially and with your family, that you were gonna go for it in that way?
That's right. I thought if I just did strictly music, we'd starve. You know, it's kind of my feeling, because I was responsible for them too. So I'd been a house painter. I grew up in Katy, Texas, painting houses for rice farmers out there when there used to be rice fields. And so I was a pretty good house painter. So that's what I got into in Rockport, just started painting houses down there. But always had the music in me, you know, in my heart. Play guitar almost every day. Play a little something, even if it's 10 or 15 minutes. I try to play every day, you know.
Right.
You know, you've got the passion. You've got the passion for it.
Hearing John's story was very impactful, you know, for me on that trip. Essentially, John was a singer-songwriter and a musician on a path towards his dream. But a twist of fate changed his life. He had just married a woman and had to make a decision about where they were going to live. Would it be a small town on the coast, or would he go to Austin where he could continue playing gigs? He threw a coin in the air, and as it landed, his fate was sealed. He decided to move to that small town, and for the most part, he became a house painter and spent a lot of his time fishing. So while Lucinda Williams was ready to get out of there, while she was moving on to another big city, John did the opposite. She went one way and he went another. Fate came upon each of them, but perhaps it wasn't fate. Perhaps it was a test of their wills. Lucinda and John both hung out in this amazing community of artists that I only dreamed of encountering. They both had that shining moment at Anderson Fair. And in a way, while they were both there, everything was held equal, and yet nothing was held equal. Just makes me so at least in terms of how everything ended up turning out.
You can do that, I guess, you know. And then you get into the what if. What if I would have done this 10 years ago? You get into the what if thing, you know. So I'd say just, if you've got the feeling that you want to go for it, I'd say just go for it and just put everything you can into it, you know. You come from a music background for sure. So you've seen a lot of the ins and outs of the business, I'm sure, through the Bluegrass Festival and just different things you've done yourself, different projects. So I would say just do it. And then if you reach a point where you go, I want to pull back from it a little bit and look at it from a distance and just do that. That's what I'd do if I was you, you know.
Yeah.
But you have a real, real pretty voice. I like your approach to the guitar, you know. I think you can do it if you really set your mind to it. I think you could.
Mm.
Really, you know, you've got the passion. You've got the passion for it. I can tell, big time. You know?
I know what you mean, though. I mean, it is a hard decision to make and to sacrifice all those other elements of your life to, like you said, it's hard to know, is this too much me just wanting to be, you know, celebrated by people thinking I'm cool, or is it, you know, what I really need to do with my time? And it's not an easy decision to make, you know.
Well, you're going to have to figure it out, because like Malcolm Holcomb said, the journey of youth is a short one.
I believe it.
Yeah.
I had not expected to discover a new insight from interviewing John. I had really just thought he would tell me about Lucinda, whether she was confident, what kind of music she liked early on, what he thought of how she sounded. But instead of finding some of this more Wikipedia-type information, I discovered John's own story in music. I discovered this tale of these two artists, ones whose paths intertwined and then separated. John had flipped a coin and decided to move to that small town. And he got to catch his own food. He didn't stop playing music by any means, but he didn't become a big superstar with a long tour history. And John sounded conflicted to me. He talked about what if, and said, I didn't think my chances were all that great. He had self-doubt. And so I wondered, from this interview and learning about these two paths, was I destined to be John, or was I destined to be Lucinda? About destiny, I looked back to my own history. You see, my desire to become a professional musician, it was all tied back to my own twist of fate, my own set of random circumstances that changed the trajectory of my life. As I was growing up, I loved music. However, I never imagined I'd be a professional. I was interested in farming, fashion, horses, traveling. I thought my work could be in one of those realms. But when I was 19, something happened. My grandfather passed away in his late 70s. And this opened doors to a new world. My grandfather had been a music lover, especially bluegrass. So when he was in his late 60s, he started his own festival. It grew throughout the years from a couple thousand to tens of thousands. And this festival, hardly strictly bluegrass, it became his legacy. And when he passed, he left behind this community that he had built up around him. A group of musicians who were older and experienced, but generous and welcoming. They reached out to me, gave me my first gigs, taught me how to write songs. And all of a sudden, at the age of 19, I realized that I could work towards being a professional musician, just like them. It seemed so amazing at the time. Incredible singers, guitar players, fiddlers, all on these big stages. I connected with artists like Buddy Miller and Jimmy Dale Gilmore. Their lives seemed incredible. These people became a North Star of my aspirations. I could be a musician, like these people, from my grandfather's community. I felt like this, being a folk country singer-songwriter, could be my destiny. Though I worked on my family's ranch, this connection to these amazing folk artists made me feel that I could work towards being just like them if I really wanted to. So back to the Am I John or Am I Lucinda thing. Over the years, I worked part-time towards being a musician while working on the ranch. And it was like being torn between two worlds, one like John Gromato's and one like Lucinda Williams's, playing locally and fishing for my own food, or touring the world and making the best, most recognizable records I could. I wanted to know more from John about the making of Ramblin' on My Mind, this record that had made me aware of his playing in the first place. After Lucinda and John played together for a while at Anderson Fair, Lucinda had that aspiration to make her first record, go into the studio, and put it out on Folkways. So she invited John to join her down in Jackson, Mississippi, for a session at Malico Studios.
It was pretty fun back then.
Mm-hmm. It was a lot of fun. I was quite shocked that she wanted me to come with her to make that record, actually. It was a surprise to me because we hadn't played together that much. And, I mean, we really didn't ever actually kind of rehearse too much from what I can remember. Even the record, we just kind of went in there and did one or two takes at the most. And we made that record in, I think, two afternoons.
Wow.
So it was like, play, okay, that's good enough. We're done. That's kind of how it was. It was kind of strange, but I don't know. Maybe it was a funding deal or something. I'm not sure. But it was interesting. This is the actual guitar case that the man that produced the record, he bought this case for me because I only had a gig bag back then.
Oh, wow.
And this is the one that went to... went to Jackson on the airplane with me to record with her. Yeah.
That's amazing.
Yeah.
So, you guys played here and you played at Malico. Do you remember what those afternoons were like when you went down to Malico and played those songs together for recording?
Well, she was already there and she was staying, I think, and maybe she had a friend or it was a friend of her father's. Had a, I think, a duplex possibly or a small house in Jackson. And so Tom Southwick bought me this case. He bought me an airplane ticket, put me on the plane. She came and picked me up the first day. I remember that. And we just kind of hung out and played a little bit. And then we recorded the very next day we went in there. I can't remember if it was morning or afternoon, but I remember it was kind of cool to me because that's the studio where Mississippi Fred McDowell had his 1 million selling record, gold record called I Do Not Play No Rock and Roll, Y'all. And when you walk in the studio, right there in front in the foyer is that gold record. And there's And I thought, okay, this is a cool place. It made me feel a little more comfortable to go in there. Mm-hmm. I'm a shy person, basically, you know, so.
Yeah.
But then the last day, I don't know, she went to give me my money, and she was, in my mind, I cannot remember it, but she had my money in the cash. I was making a sandwich. I put my meat and my cheese on, and she came over and put the money on the sandwich like the lettuce. I said, well, okay, there's an old blues song that says, put the cabbage in the jar, you know, like the tips in the jar. So I guess maybe she's putting the lettuce on the sandwich. I don't know.
Wow. It's
kind of a funny thing that happened.
That's a great story. That's so funny.
And I think it must be true, because I married my wife shortly after that, and my wife remembers me telling her that story, you know? So.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Wow.
After we made the record, she said, I'm going to Nashville, New York, or L.A., and I'm going to see if I can make it big. And that was her goal, to make it big. I think she wanted to make it.
She wanted to make it as an artist. And do you think she had any, like, doubts when you were around her about whether or not she'd be able to make that happen?
No, I think she was pretty confident, you know. I think she was pretty confident in herself.
So she wanted it from, even when she was playing covers, she really wanted to do it.
Oh, yeah. She had goals and dreams. That woman was, she was driven. I'll say that. She was driven.
So do you remember after you know, Lucinda, you talked about, came out with Passionate Kisses, and then she kind of kept making records and they got really big. Do you remember what it was like sort of for you getting to see her kind of fulfill her dreams?
Well, it was, I was really happy for her, because I knew that's what she wanted all along. And I just, when I would see her like on TV or that, I think that song won the Grammy for Song of the Year or something. And I was like, all right, she did it. She really did it, you know, and I was happy for her, you know, really happy.
Yeah.
Yeah, it gave me a feeling like, well, you know, maybe if you stick to your dreams, it can happen, you know?
Yeah.
It can happen, so that was kind of my feeling on it. But so many songwriters, there's so many good songs that people never even hear, you know?
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's true.
But hey, that's life. At least it's music and it's life. So,
yeah.
You know? So, anyway. But that's cool.
So what was
reflecting on my conversation with John Gromado, there's a few things that I've thought about. Specifically, about this idea that came up, whether I was John or whether I was Lucinda. I don't know that I could have answered that question. Only time would tell. But regardless, I think that the more interesting question would be this. When I was headed out on this journey, why did I want to be Lucinda and not John? And also, why did this community at Anderson Fair appeal to me so much? I think I wanted to be Lucinda because I wanted to feel accepted. I wanted to matter to people. Over the years, there's been nothing that has made me feel worse than not being picked for something in music. Whether it's been being on a label or a tour or for the Best of the Year article. While being picked made me feel pretty good when it did happen, the negativity of not being picked was much more motivating. When I didn't get chosen, it felt like I was at the bottom of a barrel of monkeys, like I wasn't wanted, like I wasn't needed. And Anderson Fair's community in the 70s appealed to me for a very similar reason. I wanted to be accepted into a community, but more importantly, a community that I respected. One where I felt at the same time special and equal to other people. I wanted to feel like I could write good enough songs that amongst a group of very special people, amazing songwriters, I could be accepted. I could be just as good as them. communities of artists are strange. You're doing this dance. You're trying to fit in and stand out at the same time. And perhaps it's an impossible task. As I left Anderson Fair, I felt grateful to have gotten to connect with John, to hear his story, to get to reflect upon who I saw myself as and why. But I had more questions to answer, more archives to uncover, new perspectives on Lucinda to dig up. So I decided on the next step, I would visit the studio where John and Lucinda recorded Ramblin' on My Mind. I'd have to leave John behind. He'd have to get home to work his painting job and back to his family. So I was off to Jackson, Mississippi. Unfortunately, a couple of years before doing this trip, something happened to Malico Studios, where Ramblin' was made. There was a tornado. It tore through Jackson and destroyed almost everything at Malico. However, one thing amongst all the rubble was left standing after that storm. Something wasn't destroyed. The archives. Before the storm, they had built a concrete bunker all around the reel-to-reel tapes that were stored at Malico. And this meant that perhaps, high in a shelf, there was a little treasure left for me to uncover. Thanks for listening to Finding Lucinda, Episode 5. See you on the next episode at Malico Studios.